Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bowne. Now, once again this week, I've invited in a couple of peeps to take part in this month's Something Old, Something New. This week's guests are both nature writers who also happen to be good friends. One is Melissa Harrison, author of At Hawthorne Time and Rain, Four Walks in English Weather, and Dan Richards, author of Climbing Days and Holloway. They'll be discussing the things, the places and the music that have influenced their writing on the natural world and on other aspects of their work as well. That's all ahead with Culture with me, Robert Bowne. Dan and Melissa, welcome to the programme. First of all, we'd like to establish how our guests know each other. We've had siblings on this thing, we've had work partners, we've had old lovers. Which of the above are you, if indeed they are any of the above?
I'd say we were all of those at different times. No, that's the bad thing to say, I'm sorry. I think we very likely met in a field at a festival or
caught
something.
By the River Festival
probably.
Or Port Elliot, something like that.
Yes, maybe Port Elliot. Could be.
Is this with paperback in back pocket and interviewee notes in hand, or is it 2 a.m. stumbling to the...
Oh, possibly the latter.
Okay.
Although we have interviewed each other on stage at book events and yes. chatted and hung out and generally sort of swapped notes and
yes.
gossip.
Yeah, if a summer goes past where we don't sit on stage and sort of quiz each other about what we're up to, you know, it's a bad summer.
It's a bad summer.
It's a bad
It's hardly a summer at all.
Yeah.
I think we had quite a good summer here in the UK. At least weather-wise.
Yeah, stuff was all right.
So I feel like you guys have been hanging out and you've been keeping us all in rude health.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
I mean, I'm still drinking rosé, and that to me says Indian summer.
Brave.
But
I just
know,
wish you
that was this morning instead
like,
of breakfast.
I guess I'd like our listeners to realise this show's being recorded at 10 a.m.
Yeah.
And Dan is true to his word.
I'm just yeah, absolutely.
I think the eagle-eared amongst us will be able to hear the clink of ice cubes. Here's a man who ices his rosé as well. We're going to start with you, Dan, for your Something Old, Something New. We're going to start with the old things. You've picked a novel from 1975 called Sombrero Fallout, a
yes.
Japanese novel by Richard Brautigan.
Yes.
What on earth is this?
It's a really good question. What on earth is this? I discovered
should I not have asked you that first?
No, I think everyone has the books that they are advocates for, and then they have the books where they are absolutely... You cannot... If you're in a bookshop with a friend, there are certain acid tests. You will actually walk them up to this book. You will get the book off the shelf. You will take them through the book, explain the history of the book. I, for example, would say, you know, the copy I have in my hand is a Canongate, one of the canons. Jarvis Cocker has written the introduction to it. Look at it. Isn't it beautiful? You see that a nice bit of design there. And then let's look inside. Well, some of these chapters are clearly three lines long. I mean, what's all that about?
Yeah, what is all that?
And also, it's about a sombrero that just falls out the sky. I mean, what are the first lines of this book? If this doesn't really grab you, I don't know what will. A sombrero fell out of the sky and landed on Main Street of town in front of the mayor, his cousin, and a person out of work. The day was scrubbed clean by the desert air. The sky was blue. It was the blue of human eyes waiting for something to happen. There was no reason for a sombrero to fall out of the sky. No airplane or helicopter was passing overhead, and it was not a religious holiday.
Very good.
Now,
sort of dipping our toe in a bit of magic realism there, which isn't one of my favourite genres, but the way you read it, Dan.
Yes.
Man alive, you're
exactly.
bending many a listener's.
If anybody wants an audio book of this book put out, I will happily read this book.
What do you think about it? What do you think about people auditioning for other jobs on another programme, Melissa? What do you think about that?
Well, I'm sitting here feeling quite hurt that Dan's never walked me into a bookshop and gone and selected this book from the shelves and showed it to me. So, you know, what's that about,
established,
Dan?
We only ever see each other at 2 a.m. in fields.
Okay, yeah.
Very rarely bookshops
the time is
open
not right
at that time.
Palm in the small of the back in,
yes.
in Daunts. No, indeed.
But maybe straight afterwards.
Well, let's do it now.
Well, it's probably a show to get out of the
whole,
way first.
It's a whole,
straight afterwards.
Whole other show. So where did you first come across Richard Brautigan's Sombrero Fallout? Great name, Sombrero Fallout. Where did you... Who recommended it to you, Dan?
I think it was listening to Desert Island Discs. Jarvis was on there. Hmm. It's his Desert Island book.
Oh, really?
And after that, I went in search of it. And as I say, Canongate had put out this series, The Canons. They had this circle on the front and beautifully designed. And I picked up this book and I read it. It's one of those books you can read in one sitting. It's much like Heart of Darkness, but completely different. But it's one of those really, really captivating books that just takes you on a journey. I should say the book is split into three. There is the Sombrero episode, which is actually a short story that a writer has written and then abandoned. And most of the narrative of the Sombrero and the apocalyptic goings on there happen in a waste paper basket where a story is writing itself. The writer, a humorous writer with no discernible sense of humour, is completely besotted and bereft because his Japanese girlfriend has left him. He is completely obsessed with the past of this relationship and incapable of moving forward to the extent where he can't make himself an omelette, even though he thinks he has eggs. Later it's discovered he has no eggs in the fridge anyway, so it's entirely moot. His girlfriend is asleep, ex-girlfriend, with a cat sitting near her. So this book revolves around a waste paper basket, a bereft man, a sleeping Japanese girlfriend, and sometimes inside the mind of her cat.
That's pretty amazing. And a novel that is somehow writing itself in the most postmodern of postmodern ways in said waste paper basket.
Yes.
How...
This is perfect for 2 a.m. at a literary festival.
Melissa's Melissa is narrowing her eyes suspiciously.
I'm entranced. It sounds like the kind of book that you could read when you've been drinking all day or worse.
Or anything else.
Yeah,
suddenly I get it, he cried at 3 a.m.
Yes. By Jove. Yes.
And is this it. So how many times have you read this book? Because this sounds like a triumph of style. Of one thing, and I loved that opening couple of pages you read to us at the top of the show, Dan. How many times did it take you to fall in love with it, I wonder?
I fell in love with it immediately. I think, like all great loves, it happens like a sense of revelation. It bypasses the brain and goes straight for the heart. When I've read other things that Richard Brautigan has done, I generally read Sombrero Fallout again straight afterwards.
Okay.
To remind myself how good he can be, and also compare him to whatever I've just written. Everyone talks about, I think, Trout Fishing is the famous one, the Confederate General of Big Sur. They're the ones that remain in print, but I would say Sombrero of Fallout is the masterwork because it is the most Brautigan thing, you know, and there is a mind at work here. He is coming through, and it really, really connects with me because it also shows what you can do in a very... It's not a long book, you know, I'd say it's a novella. The only reason it's so, you know, it's... How many pages is this particular edition? I don't know. Let's have a look. This is great radio. 200 pages. but some of those pages contain 2 or 3 words.
Yeah, okay. You know,
and you're flipping the whole time between perspectives. It's incredibly funny and also incredibly arresting, incredibly humane, because really he's talking about love. The whole book is secretly about love, but meanwhile there's an apocalypse happening in a waste paper basket and sometimes we're in the mind of a cat. So it's just like real life, really.
At 3 a.m. in a field.
At 3 a.m. in a field.
And do you feel that this book was wrought from heartbreak, or at least it's the subject of it?
It was his last book.
Does that come out? Does it matter that comes out if it doesn't?
It does come out. I'm aware, and actually Jarvis talks about this in his introduction, that it was Brautigan's last book. It's a masterwork. It's everything that his career and personality, his very soul was leading up to. And shortly after this was published, he died. It feels like the end of something. And as much as Bob Dylan said that when he wrote, or was it, It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, that sort of period, he thought the world was going to end. You know, it was the Cuban Missile Crisis. He had saved up all his best lines and then he just threw them at 3 songs in the course of a week because he thought that the world was running out of time and he might never get to write these 12 songs. So he threw everything into 3 songs. And you get the sense with Sombrero Fallout that Brautigan has just thrown all his best ideas at this book and they've all stuck.
It's distilled Brautigan.
Yes.
Or it's moonshine. Export strength Brautigan.
That's right.
Whether or not it was made in a bathtub, we don't know.
It's special brew Brautigan.
Okay. Good. Melissa, not giving you a big laugh there. But
no.
I felt that
she's only doing that
poem,
to hurt me. She was impressed. I was laughing.
Yeah, it was a chuckle. It was a chuckle. How beautifully told, how a man can fall in love with such an unusual book. It is from 1975. The author is Richard Brautigan. Sombrero Fallout, a Japanese novel. The last great meisterwerk by Brautigan. Maybe the only one.
Maybe.
As recommended by Dan Richards. Dan, thank you very much for talking us through that, for leading us by the hand merrily through an unusual barley field of Brautigan.
Yes.
Melissa, we're going somewhere pretty general and vast now.
And
Dan
much
chose
older.
A novella. Mm. This is much older. Melissa's trying to get brownie points for the pure age of her,
her
choice.
That is so like her.
So like her, isn't it? Which is nothing other than Dartmoor.
Yes.
Tell our listeners, who might not be from the UK, where this is, what this is, and why it holds such an allure for you, Melissa.
Dartmoor is 365 square miles of granite upland in the west of the UK. It is almost entirely given over to sheep, and it contains tors, which are outcrops of granite that can be climbed or explored, and that make walking a lot more interesting because you can go from tor to tor. You know, you're not just doing a circular walk, you're going to a particular tour and back, perhaps, or going to do 2 or 3. So there's little peaks to conquer.
There's a sense of, when you're walking it, there's a sense of achievement.
Yes.
You've got a natural kind of linkage from one place
to
the next.
It's not just bleak, empty moorland. But not, it also,
it's so much more than bleak, empty moorland.
It is. There's also, as you come down off the moor, there are beautiful farming villages. There are deep cleves filled with trees and rushing water. And it's a place where history is very much present. You can see and feel, you know, right back to prehistory, there are ancient stone circles, there are standing stones, there are medieval longhouses, there are villages that look like they haven't changed in 600 years and probably haven't. There are leats that were dug, you know, in the medieval period and are still carrying water. And it's somewhere that we went on holiday when I was a child every single year because my grandmother and grandfather lived in Ashburton. And it was the happy land of my childhood.
And it's a place that's sort of been used in fiction, and probably because it's got its basis in fact that it's a spooky place, it's an unknowable place.
I've never found it spooky.
You've never found it to be there?
No, it's a warm and welcoming place to me. I didn't read The Hound of the Baskervilles until, you know, quite late in life, maybe 10 years ago. My memories of Dartmoor are mostly tramping across it. I've got five brothers and sisters, so a long procession of us in 70s clothes, being led by my dad.
That was 10 years ago as well.
Yeah. I'm sensing this from last weekend.
Yeah.
You know, fashions go round again. They, you know, they're circular. And my dad would be briskly leading these often complaining children, and the phrase, rise above it.
Whether
it was raining.
Great fatherly advice.
Or it was too hot, or we were thirsty or tired or hungry, he'd say, rise above it. And we'd, you know, complain and be miserable. But it was a great lesson because it taught us. It gave us resilience, really, and it taught us that you can keep going even when you're in some discomfort. You know, it might be raining, but, you know, nobody's going to die. It's fine.
Even when your bell-bottoms are soggy.
Oh,
and,
soggy, yeah. Really soggy bell-bottoms. Cagoules in the 70s were not particularly effective.
Yeah. Birkenstocks really not up to the challenge of Dartmoor. Yeah, I can see this.
So there was whinging, but it was a really good lesson, and it gave us a connection with the outdoors that I think kids naturally move away from in their teenage years, but if you've got it there, it's there to go back to later in life.
Did you move away from the natural world in your teenage years?
Or
was it something? Yeah.
I really did, yeah.
So react against all that lovely nature that you love so much, you care about so much.
It didn't feel like a reaction against, it just felt like it got forgotten amongst sort of, you know, teenage concerns and growing up and then moving to London in my early 20s. And it wasn't until I had a relationship breakup and found myself at a really low ebb and went back to Dartmoor in my mid-20s and had this sort of revelation of, God, it's still here. You know, you move away from places and you feel like they've stopped existing because you aren't seeing them anymore.
Yeah.
And to go back and go, God, it's been here all this time, and actually I can just go here whenever I want.
What was that feeling like when you reconnected for the first time after this breakup? You're in your early 20s, say, what does that feel like? Does that feel, is it like an old friend? Or can you behave in a way that you weren't able to behave in the city, perhaps?
Yes, very much so. And it was that really that kickstarted my process of trying to reconnect with nature. In London, when I came back, I felt like this is actually something that's missing from my life and I need to find it. And I realised that you can find and connect emotionally with nature in a city. You just have to go and look for it in a different way. And that means tuning into it and noticing it. And that sort of, I eventually moved to a flat with a garden. At that point, I could get a dog. Walking the dog meant that I could go out and discover, you know, parks and green spaces every day because the dog needs a walk every day. And out of that came my first book, Clay, which was quite an evangelical book, really. I wanted to wake other people up to the idea that on your walk to the bus stop or your commute or whatever it is in London, you can have an experience which is kind of connected in a way to the living world and not just to traffic and pollution and advertising and litter.
And just finally on Dartmoor, going back, it's such a vastness to it. Are you, when you go back, looking for the places that you remember loving as a kid or even just the last time you visited, or are you looking to discover?
There are pilgrimages. So there's a particular tour where we used to go as children. It was the first place we went whenever we arrived, and we would throw a little stone from the top of the tour for each person that we wanted to make a wish for. And it's also where we scattered my mum's ashes. And so I will always go back there. But I like to discover new places too. I think it's about the marks of man's habitation on the land, which are so apparent there, and that comes through in everything I write now. It's I'm not just looking for bleakness, I'm looking for the connection between mankind and a landscape. That's what moves me.
And something, obviously, that you find so much more in the city, but there is something more beautiful about an ivy trailing up a wall, knowing the wall's man-made.
The traces are quite recent because the deep past gets covered over very quickly in urban areas. But in Dartmoor, you can look at the marks of the Victorians and the medieval, and then further back. It's all there to be read, and I find that really moving.
Beautifully described Dartmoor, no small concern. Dartmoor itself, is Melissa Harrison, something old. Thank you so much for talking us through that in such a personal way. Something new time.
Yes.
New fans. Mark Doty, the poet, who is a name who I hadn't encountered before. You flagged us up, Dan, and wanted to read something about it. Give us a little bit of a background on Mark and on why you love him.
Well, my introduction to Mark Doty was very much circuitous and around the houses. While I was writing my Climbing Days book, I received a very mysterious letter from a lady, and the letter ran something along the lines of, "When I was a child, I met your great-great-aunt and uncle, and they were the focus of that book." And she said, "My parents knew them very well. I was a child. My parents are dead. I really can't remember very much. So I don't really see how I can be much help to be honest. But if you want to come down to Dorset and see me about them, you're very welcome. But as I say, I don't think it'll be worth your while. All best wishes, Salima Hill." And at the time, I was...
The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away.
Indeed.
Sentence by sentence.
What a strange circular letter. Yeah. But it was wonderful. It's always nice to receive letters anyway. And the name rang a bell. And Salima Hill turns out to be... as you know, a lot of your listeners hopefully will know, just the most wonderful, amazing poet. And again, you were talking about magical realism, the Brautigan, and she really embodies a kind of very Angela Carter-esque, earthy, bloody magical realism in her poetry. And, you know, she's a real cult figure. And the fact she'd written me such a strange letter. So I responded and I said, "Hello, I'm not sure how to respond to this letter, but thank you so much." And then we got talking, and it turned out that she was on the shortlist for the T.S. Eliot Poetry Prize last year, but she wasn't going to go because she doesn't do that sort of thing.
Okay. I sense she might not be.
No, that would be too easy to actually turn up, the South Bank and actually, read.
Be lauded.
And she said, "Do you want to go instead of me?" And I said, "Well, will I have to stand on stage and read your poetry?" She went, "Oh, no, don't be silly. There are people for that, Dan." Sorry, that was ridiculous. But I ended up going along in her stead, I think with her granddaughter, and there we both were, and almost everybody else was reading, and Mark Doty was on stage because he was also shortlisted, and he read this poem. And so my introduction to his work came from the man himself on stage at Royal Festival Hall reading a couple of poems from the collection Deep Lane, which was shortlisted, and it absolutely blew me away. And then I got a copy of the book and I read the book, and then it sat next to my bed with all the books in the big Pisa-like pile of toppling books that are next to my bed. But I've spent the last month in America, and the book went with me to America, because just before leaving, I remembered this particular poem, "This Your Home Now." And with everything that's going on in America, with everything that's going on in the world, it struck me that I needed that when I went to America, just because this poem, for me at least, is everything that America should be. It involves interaction with strangers. It involves different people from all over the world who happen to be in New York. That idea of melting pot, that idea of welcome, that idea of deep time, that idea of belonging, which in a way America, in my mind at least, sits at the heart of that idea. It should be a place of the possible. A place where people make themselves and make a new story.
And I love that in the title itself, you're kind of wondering in a punctilious way whether they've left out a comma,
yes,
or an is, and realising that sod that, it's just like so much more beautiful and direct and American, and it's in its sort of brokenness. So we have a clip, Dan. This is Mark Doty reading a little slice of "This Your Home Now."
Dull early winter, back on 18th, just past the post office, up spiraling red in a cylinder of glass, and just below the line of sidewalk, a new sign, "Willie's Barbershop." Dark hallway, glass door, and there's, presumably, Willie. When I tell him I used to go down the street, he says in an inscrutable accent, "This your home now." Puts me in a chair, asks me what I want, and soon he's clipping and singing with the radio's Latin dance tune. That's when I notice Willie's walls, though he's been here all the week, spangled with images hung in barbershops since the beginning of time. Lounge singers, near celebrities, Random boxers, Italian boys, Puerto Rican, caught in the hour of their beauty, though they'd scowl at the word. Cheering victors over a trophy won for what? Frames already dusty at slight angles. Here, it's clear forever.
Mark Doty reading an excerpt of This Your Home Now from Deep Lane, as chosen by Dan Richards. I think there is further reading to be done on Deep Lane and Mark Doty, obviously. Dan, thanks for talking us through it. And by the way, did this nourish you on your trip to the United States last month?
Yes, it was wonderful. And also, it was a small tome, which is good when you're running around the USA. I'm glad that I didn't take, you know, his complete collected work that's the size of the Bible.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a nice pamphlet-sized thing, which I would advise everyone.
And maybe you can come in next time and read the full thing.
Along with my audiobook of some rare fallout that I'm working on.
Yeah, exactly. Sod Bill Nighy. We've got Dan Richards in the house.
Steady on.
Dan, thank you very much for talking us through Mark Doty, This Your Home Now from Deep Lane. Melissa, you're something new. It's been going on for quite a while as well. You've gone, as Dan has bored down into the specificity of some of the language and some of the writers and poets he loves, you've gone for another broad church here.
I have.
Dartmoor, we go to dance music.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. And also, what I loved when you flagged this up as something you wanted to talk about, I was like, yes, this is the nature writer that's getting on one. Right?
This is me coming out of the closet.
Yeah, exactly. So let's go to dance. Should we take a little... Why don't you introduce our listeners to something that is emblematic of the sort of dance music that you like?
With pleasure. This is a track called In White Rooms by Booker Shade.
Thought Melissa Harrison was just reciting Keats to herself as she walked across Dartmoor, but in fact it's In White Rooms, original mix brackets by Booker Shade.
Yeah, I'm having a slightly Pavlovian moment here.
Yeah, are you? Where are we going?
Slightly. We're going back to the
You're
cross.
You're remembering how you met Dan now? Oh, the cross!
No, much further back. I don't even know if Dan's a dance music man, are you, Dan?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. That was good.
Truly.
And talking about Pavlovian moments, everyone got the water out at that moment.
I know.
It's your show.
Everyone went for the water. It's like, oh, it's important to keep hydrated,
it's
isn't
really
it?
Hot. Yeah, it's good. So tell us about where did the love affair with dance music come from? And people will want to know how this is not incongruous with the love of getting out into the great outdoors and that great improvement in Kugel technology from the 1970s.
I think it is incongruous, actually, and that's part of the appeal for me. My other job is I'm production editor at a dance music magazine called Mix Mag and have been for 12 years. But long beyond that, I remember the second summer of love, 1988.
Yeah.
I was 13, so I was too young to take part in the M25 raves or go to Shoom or anything like that, but it was in the air. The older kids at school, there was a lot of sneakily showing off your pot of Vicks that you had and one white glove, all of that. I think my older sister went to some of the raves. But I was 18 when I discovered dance music for myself, and it was my first year at Oxford. I went to a comprehensive school and from there to Oxford, where I didn't fit in at all, as you can imagine. I already hadn't fitted in at comprehensive, where I was clever and bookish and bespectacled and bullied. And I got to Oxford and began going out with a guy who became my first husband. Bless him, lovely man. We used to go to Club UK in London. We used to get the Oxford Tube, coach to London. Go out all night and then get the coach back in the morning, because there was no subculture at all in Oxford that I could discover. It was about working really hard, which I also did, and I'm proud of how well I did, but there wasn't anywhere else to be apart from the university. There was boat club cocktails, things like that.
Yeah.
And if you weren't going to fit in with that, there wasn't a lot for you. And what I discovered was, and you know, it sounds like a massive cliche, but I discovered a sense of community that was incredibly important to me at the time. I discovered somewhere I fitted in, and I discovered that I was acceptable and could be accepted by other people, and that's never worn off, and I needed that.
And that's something that is talked about so much with dance music, that idea of community. We did a program a few shows back last month about, and it was kind of kicked off by this Sky Arts thing called The Agony and the Ecstasy, this four-part show on Sky Arts that got a lot of the main protagonists of that second Summer of Love and then what came afterwards, who became superstar DJs and all the rest of it. But it started far more innocently, maybe less innocently, but far more homegrown than that anyway. And a lot of people said that it was the sense of community that first kind of got them.
Yeah, it really was. Together. I mean, you know, it's a behemoth now and it's international and America having invented dance music in Chicago and Detroit and New York and then forgotten about it has rediscovered it, which is great for Mixmag. You know, in particular, it's kept us going and given us a huge revival, a huge boost. But for a long time, when I first discovered it, it really was a subculture. It was like joining a secret club. You would occasionally meet someone and you'd say, do you go to clubs? And they'd be like, oh, yeah, I do. Oh, OK. And you would have a bond based on that. It's hard to imagine now. But I think what was important to me in terms of writing was that it allowed me to feel comfortable with being an outsider. It allowed me to have to take some strength and even pride in not fitting into the mainstream. And that, for me, has been a really important position to take. And it's something that I'm now really comfortable with. And I think it informs my writing because it can give you empathy when you're not on the inside of things. It can give you empathy with other types of ways to live, other kinds of people. And now I find myself deliberately trying to stay in the slightly uncomfortable position on the outskirts of things. So even in, you know, the conservation world, I don't entirely fit in. There's lots of conservation issues that I don't take a firm position on or a firm side, because what's really important to me is to be flexible, to be intellectually and imaginatively flexible. And that means not quite finding a home anywhere. And dance music and the community around that allowed me to do that at a young age when I was quite vulnerable and actually on the surface I wanted to fit in. And it's given me the strength to take up and inhabit that now. And that's been absolutely vital, I think.
And there's an intellectual position at which your two worlds meet. And obviously they're not two worlds for you. At what point do they meet? Because I feel that there's an extreme sense of the pastoral, actually, in so much of festival culture, and certainly in dance music culture, there is the sunrise moment, but there is the thing after that. Of course, there is something, I guess, pastoral about it. I think there's a great folk horror film to be made amongst the mixing these two worlds. In fact,
yeah, and there's a lot of artists that are working along those margins now. So James Holden's just about to put out a new album which has huge folk influences. There's artists like Grasscut, who are fantastic electronica, you know, influenced really by English landscapes. It's a really fertile area at the moment, and I'm fascinated by it.
It's amazing stuff. We've kind of run out of time. You both spoke so poetically and beautifully about things that obviously you brought along and are wonderful and are great to kind of take examples from, but clearly kind of infiltrate themselves into your practice and go back very far. So thank you both for being amusing and honest.
Absolute
and
pleasure.
Bewitching in equal measure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just to recap, Melissa Harrison was talking about dance music, something that set her free and gave a community back in the day and still, and from it, she chose Book of Shade in White Rooms, the original mix, as an example. Before that, Deep Lane by Mark Doty. We had a little bit of This Your Home Now, as chosen by Dan Richards. And we kicked off with The Place That Is Dartmoor, no small national park, does Melissa Harrison deal in. And, of course, Richard Brautigan's Sombrero Fallout, a Japanese novel from way back in 1975, the crowning achievement of an overlooked writer, possibly. Who knows, Dan Richards?
I would say so.
Thank you both very much indeed. Now, there are new things that you must come on and tell us about next time, because you hinted that you were going to possibly talk about your new book, Melissa, but we kind of don't have time, but we do have an extra slot with your name on it, both of your names on it, whenever you want to come back. Thank you both very much.
Very kind. Thank you.
Indeed. Today's show was produced by Holly Fisher, and thanks to Bill Luty and Jolene Goffin for helming the Good Ship Culture while Holly swanned off to Barcelona. Tune in at the same time next week. For the time being, I've been Robert Pound, and thank you very much for tuning in.